This is 91.5 FM. W program do not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University administration, or the Board of Trustees. Today we feature a special two-hour-long excerpt of a conversation with Majid Nawaz, once an Islamist revolutionary, now transformed into an anti-extremism advocate for tolerance. Majid Nawaz was born to Pakistani parents in the United Kingdom and was the target of routine racial attacks while growing up there, during one of which he watched his friend die. As a teenager, he joined an international Islamist revolutionary group and rose quickly to become its national leader and recruited members from across Europe. He was imprisoned by Egyptian security agencies soon after September 11, 2001, and witnessed frequent extreme torture inside the prison, where he also met a wide spectrum of Muslims from around the world. During his four-year prison sentence, he became disenchanted with fundamentalist ideology, and upon his return to the UK in 2006, he renounced the group, divorced his wife, and resumed his college education. Majid Nawaz studied law and Arabic at the University of London and earned a master's degree in political theory from the London School of Economics. He met with Presidents Bush and Obama and UK Prime Minister Cameron to promote anti-extremism and tolerance. One of his books, Islam and the Future of Tolerance, he co-authored with Sam Harris. He ran for UK Parliament in 2013. From 2016 until January 2022, he hosted a popular nationwide radio call-in show in the UK. We join Majid Nawaz in this two-hour excerpt from a three-hour conversation recorded on February 17th with Joe Rogan.
That story fascinates. Why would you do that, though? Why would any individual give a reason for doing thing A and then ditch that reason and do exactly the opposite for thing B? It shows you that's not the reason.
Well, one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you is because I think your perspective is so much different than anyone else's because when you were radicalized, because of your time in prison, and because of the incredibly rational way you pursue truth and the way you discuss things now. I've seen your BBC program and I've seen you give talks. You have a very clean and rational way of addressing and breaking down all these processes that are in place that cause people to behave a certain way. You understand it because you were radicalized yourself as well. You understand the mind play that I think is oftentimes... it's known of but not discussed and certainly not understood deeply like you do. And I think that is the key to all of us understanding what's going on right now, that there's a lot of panic, there's a lot of moral outrage and a lot of virtue signaling, a lot of signaling to the tribe, but then there's also these forces that have been moving in play as what you call mission creep, and this is an opportunity for them to push even further in this general direction. And I don't think many people are aware of that. And I think they're looking at it in terms of what their ideology supports, whether their ideology is pro-vaccination or their ideology is pro-open borders or pro-closed, whatever it is. Like, people are locked into a pre-arranged, predetermined group of ideas and opinions that you have adopted that you will support. And it's become almost like a religion.
Yeah.
And religions, the problem with the term religion is we always think of it involving a deity. Mm. And it doesn't have to involve a deity. It can the ideas become the deity. The signaling to the group becomes a deity.
Yeah.
I think you know that more than anyone.
Well, this brings us to contemporary times. After shutting Quilliam down, there was a bit of an overlap, but I primarily became a talk show host on a UK mainstream radio station, and we had call-ins as well. And COVID struck, and I had to take a view on it. Now, I'm double jabbed, and the reason I am is right at the beginning, I gave the benefit of the doubt to the narrative, to the authorities telling us what we needed to do right at the start. And I thought, you know what, I'm not anti-vax in principle, so fine, you know. I had no reason to question any of it. What happened is, once they implemented this emergency law, they ditched all of our rights in the UK under this Coronavirus Emergency Act. Now, I've seen that before. That's why I said we'll come back to emergencies.
Yes.
Right? I've seen that story play out before. And the problem is the minute the government takes your rights, there are still blowback, legislative blowback from the war on terror that we still haven't got rid of.
Patriot Act.
In the US. In the UK, the right to silence is now in any port of entry or exit in the UK. Heathrow Airport, shipping port. It's now a criminal offence to stay silent if a counterterrorism investigation is conducted on you. The Terrorism Act 2000 has criminalized your right to silence.
So if you are investigated or interviewed by someone and you choose to be silent, they just lock you in jail for that.
It happened to me. So when I got out of prison, the Terrorism Act 2000 was already in place. I was released from prison in 2006. I was interrogated under this power, and I was informed directly by a police officer, your silence is a criminal offence, as is refusing your right for us to take your DNA. So they took my DNA by force, and I had no right to silence, and I had no right to a lawyer. Now, what's changed since then is they reformed the DNA part. They've reformed the legal representation, but the right to silence is still, that's still there. It's been taken away. Mm. Now, that's an example of a hangover from the war on terror. There's many. If you remember, under Blair, they tried to extend detention without charge for 90 days. So emergencies, the Patriot Act in the US, emergencies are always used by the state for a power grab.
Yes.
It's the nature of human beings.
It's an opportunity.
Yes.
It's an opening that you do.
Of course
it is. It's like if in an MMA fight, if someone stumbles, you dive on his back. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you exploit it?
Yeah, it's natural.
You're there to win.
Yes.
You know, and you want to beat your opponent. So.
And it's a massive opportunity to change the paradigm. Yeah. You change everything that's happening. Mm.
So when the minute they suspended our rights under the Coronavirus Emergency Act is the minute my light started switching on, like, uh-oh, where's this going
to
head?
Did you use your platform to advocate for a different approach? Did you say how you felt about this idea of stripping away laws in the idea under the guise of protecting people, that this is not only unnecessary, but it's unproductive and it leads to bad things. And instead, there could be some sort of advocacy campaign for vaccination or advocacy campaign for doing responsible things and social distancing and not taking it to the extreme of changing laws.
So look, yes. And where I'm coming from is, back to Egypt, they injected me against my will in prison.
With what?
Who knows?
Just inoculations?
Who knows what it was?
Right.
We were taken and, you know, you've just come out of a torture dungeon.
Right.
And you're going to fight with them and get sent back to the dungeon. You're going to let them put whatever they want in your arm. So we had, in the first place, we were prisoners of conscience under duress, which is why in principle it was against our will. And there's no point trying to fight it. So coming from that background, the minute in the UK they started saying, if you don't get your jab, we're going to sack you. Right? No job, no jab, they called it, yeah? If you don't get this vaccination, you can't travel. And then it started going from there, mission creep. If you don't get this vaccination, we're going to have a lockdown only for the unvaccinated, which some European countries announced. If you don't get this vaccination, well, you know, we're going to start looking at whether you have to pay a fine every month, which some European countries announced, and some media pundits in the UK were openly advocating on the airwaves, right? You start hearing this rhetoric, and you've got to appreciate, I've come from the background where I've had to reason myself out of a totalitarian agenda and embrace instead something I believe I can hold on to and bring people towards. What was that thing? Well, through the inspiration of Amnesty, it was essentially our values grounded in civil liberties and democracy. I've lost a family over that struggle, yeah? To commit to, in that war on terror, to fighting a war, an ideological war, to defeating darkness in the form of terrorism that was beginning to engulf the Muslim mind. I've sacrificed a lot in that struggle to come out on the other end of everything I fought for, only to be told that the thing I'm defending is going to start doing the same thing. The state is going to start telling me what I have to put in my body and when, and if I don't agree, I can't travel. If I don't agree, I can't work. If I don't agree, I can't leave my home.
Now, to play devil's advocate, from their perspective, they want to get people to be inoculated because they want to protect the population, they want to slow the spread of this deadly disease, and they want to bring society back to normal as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. They see the tools that are at their disposal and they decide to use the law to try to make it forced, to try to coerce people into getting vaccinated for their better good.
And there's a bipartisan consensus on what you just said.
Right.
The last time there was a bipartisan consensus on such a big lie was the invasion of Iraq.
When you say such a big lie,
it's a lie.
What is a lie about it?
The COVID vaccination doesn't stop infection, it doesn't stop transmission.
But it does in the beginning, right?
It reduces it for 12 weeks, after which point...
Is it only 12 weeks?
12 weeks.
Doesn't it vary per person?
So younger people don't need it. Of course, for older people, when we look at the studies, it's 12 weeks, after which point it reduces to the similar levels in terms of infection and transmission as the unvaccinated. Now, we have the academic papers to demonstrate that, but actually, if you look at real-world data today, right now, England, that doesn't have vaccine passports, compared to Wales and Scotland that do, and we have lower rates in England... Even the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is on camera saying this thing doesn't stop infection or transmission. I'd argue with you. That's why England has ditched the entire thing yesterday.
But isn't it because they thought it did initially?
Yeah, but
initial laws were put into place, the consensus was that it stopped transmission, it stopped infection, and it protected you from hospitalization and death.
So,
right?
I'm prepared to, on the principle of charity, I'm prepared to assume that's what they thought.
It seems like that was the general consensus amongst medical experts in the early days of the vaccine. That's why, many of them that are now, they've come out against these mandates, they talk about the initial days of it, what it was like, and this is why they were in support of this.
I'm prepared to concede on the principle of charity without knowing those guys. I mean, I know there were people that weren't establishment scientists that were saying from day one, they were saying there's something wrong with this, but let's apply the principle of charity, because we should.
Yes, we should. Yes,
The minute it became clear, because this is such an egregious violation of human dignity, the minute it became clear, this should have been ditched. But it hasn't, you know. Until today, even in my country, Scotland and Wales haven't dropped these mandates. Now, the other point, though, is that let's assume that was their intention. I've got a deeper question, which goes beyond the science. And that is that if you've got the power to dictate to people what to put in their bodies on behalf of other people, right? And you're the state, and that's the law you bring in. Now, that, I believe, is such a fundamental shift in our social contract, in the relationship between you and the state,
yes,
that it requires not only a broader discussion, I think that requires a democratic mandate to bring in, because it's such a fundamental change in direction in Western liberal democracies when it comes to the relationship we have with the state. What do I mean by that? If I said to you, Joe, listen, you've got two kidneys, man. I need one. And you're going to give it to me because the state says you have to look after me. Now, if I have done that without your involvement, without your choice, for the common good, and I have the power to be able to do that, and the reasoning I'm giving is that there are people that deserve this kidney and you have a spare one, and that you have to look after other people. Now, it could be kidneys, it could be anything, it could be any medical procedure, and generally beyond that, it can be anything you have to do for other people's sake. Now, if I want to redefine that relationship, because up until now, you had every right to say, my blood is my blood, and I know someone needs a blood donation or an organ donation. I know I should care for people, but it's still my decision. If I'm going to change that and say it's no longer your decision, right, then it requires a broader and deeper conversation, and it requires, I'd say, that's referendum-level change in our culture. Yeah?
Yeah.
Like Switzerland has referendums. It's like Brexit referendum in the UK. It's referendum-level shift, because it sets the precedent that going forward, I have a 5-year-old. If I surrender this debate now and I'm 44 years old and say, yes, okay, state, on behalf of protecting Joe, you can force me to do certain medical procedures because I have to think about Joe, right? I've surrendered my individual bodily autonomy for the common good. My 5-year-old boy is never going to know what it felt like to say, my body, my choice. Now, what I don't understand is the cognitive dissonance. Because on the one hand, we argue my body, my choice when it comes to abortion, and we suddenly ditch that principle when it comes to vaccination or inoculation.
Well, the answer to that is vaccination and inoculation protects those around you.
Mm.
That's what they would say.
So peanuts, yeah?
Peanuts?
Yeah. So some people have a
allergy
to peanuts. It's a minority of people, right? But it's the reason why, and you'll know this, anyone will know this, you go into a restaurant and they ask, do you have any allergies before I order the food?
Right.
Yeah. And the reason they do that is because if there's even a trace of a peanut in that dish, you could die. If I'm going to start mandating these injections, we know that there is a rare side effect. We know that there are some people that die from them. Lisa Shaw was a BBC journalist who died after her AstraZeneca vaccine, as officially ruled by the coroner and written up by the BBC. I'm in touch with her husband, right? His name is Gareth.
Now, are they more transparent about injuries over there?
They've started to be, because our resistance has been very fierce to all of this. England is a bit of an outlier now. They just ditched everything yesterday. All of their kind of, there's a lot more to do, but they've ditched what they called Plan B, the whole idea of vaccine passports,
mm-hmm.
because there's been such a fierce resistance to this. So take it back to that
peanut. So this woman.
Yeah. So if I mandate injections, right, vaccination, some people are going to die, because we know that there is a side effect that some people die from this thing. Death is a side effect. Yes, minority of people, but it's like peanuts.
Right.
Right. Now, it's insane to mandate peanuts in every meal. Right. So again, back to looking
right,
after.
But peanuts don't have any. There's no protecting other people by eating
exactly.
a peanut.
So go back to the original, because we know that doesn't apply anymore.
Right.
Beyond 12 weeks, it doesn't even protect people anymore. But let's go back to the original and give them the.
But doesn't it
of doubt.
Still protect them from hospitalization and death?
Isn't
that
depending on age?
Depending on
age. Depending on age. Right. So you know, a 5-year-old definitely not. 12-year-old no. My dad, he's in his 80s, like late 70s, 80s. Yeah, he's had his boosters.
Yeah.
You know, so and he's got comorbidities. So if the infection fatality rate is 0.096%, like the flu, right? Now, the Office for National Statistics in the UK, through a Freedom of Information request, has just revealed the number of people who died solely from COVID with no other coexisting illness. 17,731, if my memory serves. It's definitely 17,700 and something. Total number of people from the beginning of this pandemic who've died only from COVID.
And this is only in Britain?
In Britain, right? We were told the figure was in the hundreds of thousands.
Right.
Now, this is all coming out in the UK now. Yeah. There's a bit of a retreat from all of this narrative.
But isn't the problem with that narrative that so many people have comorbidities and we have to protect them too? Like, the thing about this country is there's a large percentage of us that are obese.
Yeah.
It's probably somewhere right. in the neighborhood. We looked at it, right? Was it like 40% or something like that? So it's a very high level. Like, what do we do?
So Lisa Shaw and others. So you're going to say, I'm going to sack somebody who doesn't protect the other person, yeah? So what we're saying is, and this is what I'm saying requires a proper debate because it's a shift in our culture.
I'm just playing devil's advocate. I know.
I've heard you speak on this. Lisa Shaw, who died after her AstraZeneca vaccine, was that death worth it because somebody else can't control their dietary habits?
Well, is that, I mean, obviously comorbidities vary. It's not just her dietary habits. Someone could have like some serious autoimmune disorder. There's quite a few different things that constitute. Yeah. The big one is dietary habits, though.
Obesity is huge.
So
if somebody is vulnerable in any other way, what we've done with every other illness to date is that the vulnerable person has to protect themselves through a number of means. Yeah?
Yes.
And we do what's reasonable to make sure the vulnerable person is looked after. What we have never done is say that I'm responsible for your comorbidities and your extra health problems, and I have to take something at risk of losing my job that might have a side effect in me and could even kill me.
Yes.
By law. Because I lose my job or I can't travel, I can't go into this restaurant.
Right.
Now, for me, the science by the way, is clear, but let's assume this whole conversation is built on the principle of charity that they didn't know the science at the time.
Right.
That still doesn't, that doesn't exonerate us from the political conversation that was needed about what kind of society we want to live in. Because for me, if you get to a point like New York is today, Wales and Scotland, where you're telling me that I need to show identification before going into a restaurant, before going into a hotel, concert, we've got a papers, please society in that case.
Yes.
Now, you can't go from a democracy to a papers, please society within one election term without having any consultation with the public on this. And without having a proper and informed debate about how this will permanently change the culture of our society. And that's, for me, a bigger problem. I mean, the science is clear, as I say, but let's have this entire conversation on the assumption that when they initially brought it in, they were genuine, right? Even though now it's proven that that's not the case, but that's fine. I'm willing to give people the benefit of the doubt. You want me to concede that from now on and permanently, the state can tell me what to put in my body for the sake of the common good and to continue to do so every 6 months with a vaccination that hasn't been tested for any long-term side effects. I just have to accept that the state knows what's best for me and always does the right thing. Now, as I say, the last time there was a bipartisan state-based consensus on something so meaningfully wrong was the invasion of Iraq. Now, you're speaking to somebody who's been on the blunt end of what happens when a state gets something so wrong, yeah? There is no way you can undo what I've seen in my life to know that the state doesn't always act in our best interests. And there is no way that you can remove those experiences from me. Now, especially when you're talking to somebody who's been injected against his will in prison, right? And the ethnic minority case here, whether it's here in the US with the African-American communities and the whole experience of medical abuse by the state, or I'll move it again to personal example. In Pakistan, the CIA conducted a fake vaccination program on children in the hunt for bin Laden. That's not even concealed. It's been admitted. Is that Jamie? Yo, Jamie, you can look it up. Vox's report, everyone's report, because they've admitted it and apologized for it now. In the hunt for bin Laden, there was a fake hepatitis B vaccine program on children, collecting all their DNA to try and see if they were related to bin Laden so they could trace bin Laden. This is why in Pakistan, my family's country of origin, the Taliban blow up vaccination centers because they think they're CIA fronts, right? So while he's looking that up, I'll keep telling you this story. There we are. How the CIA's fake hepatitis B vaccine program in Pakistan helped fuel vaccine distrust.
Wow.
Now, you know, what is that? Is that on Fox?
They had a fake hepatitis B vaccine program.
And Jamie, if you scroll down, it may even contain the CIA's apology in there.
Whoops.
But many of them do, once it got exposed, yeah? But again, Joe, the only way this gets exposed is when people like us have these conversations.
Yeah.
Now, you're trying to, not you, but, you know, people are trying to convince me that none of this happened. That the state's always had my best interests at heart. I can't undo those experiences and those memories and the treatment to say, okay, you were wrong on Iraq and you actually lied. You were wrong with this hepatitis B vaccination program in Pakistan. My family still live there. Okay, you were wrong there and you lied and you did this fake program using vaccines. But you know what? Okay, you were wrong there. But oh, and you were wrong when you injected me in prison, one of your allies, Mubarak, who was one of the closest allies of America after Israel in the Middle East. But this time you're telling me the truth. No, I'm going to question. I'm not saying you're lying.
Right.
I'm not saying anyone's lying, by the way.
But that's a thing where, under crisis, people do not like people questioning the narrative, because the narrative may offer us relief from this uncomfortable moment we find ourselves currently in.
Mm.
And we all collectively look to something to help us out of this.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, it's a vaccine. So the vaccines became this thing that you are not allowed to challenge. And even
religion.
Though we have this dodgy history with the pharmaceutical companies, you're supposed to ignore that.
Yeah.
Supposed to completely put that on the back burner.
Well, this is where, again, you can't undo what I know about this, right? So let's try another one. Can you look up who paid the largest criminal fine in history? Thank you, Jamie. Sorry to give you orders. But who paid that? So the assumption that pharmaceutical companies are acting in your best interest, just like the assumption that the CIA, when it encourages these things, vaccination programs in, say, Pakistan, is acting in your best interest, is an assumption that has to be interrogated. Now, we know here in America, the opioid crisis, that the medical establishment was abused. And the opioid crisis here in the States ended up killing more people than the AIDS crisis. Yeah. Now, pharmaceuticals make a lot of money out of this. And so with the who paid the largest criminal fine in history, you probably get two results, depending on your search engine. And though you don't need to put in the word who paid the largest pharmaceutical fine in history, you can just say who paid the largest criminal fine in history, and you'll get GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer. And the difference is, I think the difference was that GlaxoSmithKline have paid the largest accumulative fine, and Pfizer has paid the largest fine in one big go. Yeah. And you can go to something called the Violation Tracker. Since the year 2000, it documents all of the criminal and civil violations that Pfizer has been found on the wrong side of and has paid fines for. And so this assumption that big pharmaceutical companies are acting in our best interests, again, is an assumption that has to be interrogated, because yes, it's during an emergency where debate is being silenced that it becomes incredibly important to ask these questions.
Yes.
Otherwise, it gets snuck in and you can never undo it.
And when you were working at the BBC, you started doing what you always do, is you're questioning narratives, you're discussing ideas openly and objectively. What kind of pushback are you getting?
So it was LBC.
Oh, LBC.
Yeah, which is, Global is the largest commercial radio group in the UK, and they have music channels and what have you. And then one of them was the talk radio side called LBC. And I was having these sorts of conversations. And without going into whatever, you know, because I'm no longer there. So for legal reasons, I don't want to get into what specifically happened. What I will say is I was scheduled to go on the very next weekend after returning from my Christmas break in Tennessee. And a day before my schedule was, I had a weekend show. And it was doing really well. You know, imagine a weekend lunchtime when everyone should be in their restaurants having a good time, having their Bloody Marys, having their Sunday roasts. And I was getting over 500,000 listeners on a weekend lunchtime for only two shows a week. And it went from a graveyard shift to being a really, you know, respected slot. One day before reappearing this month, they told me that my services were no longer required. But the part isn't in dispute. The indisputable part is my contract was on until April, but I'm not there anymore.
Did they have a conversation with you at any point in time before that where they're like, well, you probably can't talk about that?
I can't talk about that. Yeah. But I know that what I will say is why other people outside of my then bosses were upset with me, including in the organization, was because I was having these sorts of conversations I'm having with you. That CIA Pakistan thing, multiple times mentioned it on my show. I actually physically pulled out my phone and asked my listeners to Google who paid the largest criminal fine in history and had them call in. Yep, Pfizer.
Mm.
You know? So that kind of conversation where I'm trying to, by the way, all while being double jabbed. I got two Pfizer vaccinations, right? So people still throwing anti-vaxxer labels at me.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. It's like
heretic.
The Southern Poverty Law Center called me an anti-Muslim extremist.
Whoa.
And they listed me as an anti-Muslim extremist. At the same time, there's a database called Thomson Reuters World Check. All the banks, all the large accountancy firms, all the big money firms in Wall Street, in the City of London, they all subscribe to World Check, because if you have a bank account, they want to make sure that you're not funding terrorism. So World Check is a database that categorizes you as to whether you're clean or not when it comes to finances from a terrorism lens. I'm probably the only person you'll meet on the planet that was simultaneously listed by World Check, Thomson Reuters, under category red terrorism as a Muslim terrorist, while listed at the same time by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-Muslim extremist. Right?
But didn't they say Sam was one of those too?
They didn't list him. But Ayan Ersiali was listed. So what I did is I sued them both. And I won against Thomson Reuters World Check. They had to publicly apologize in court, remove that defamation, and they paid damages. And I sued the Southern Poverty Law Center. That didn't get to court because before disclosure, they publicly put out a video, apologized, and paid damages. But what that story serves to tell you is that when you question these things, today it's so lazy and easy to throw labels at people. So being double jabbed, they call me an anti-vaxxer. Being a Muslim that had literally gone to jail for my faith, they were calling me an anti-Muslim extremist. And this is how absurd these people are. That you disagree with somebody, and instead of trying to engage with the substance of your point, they want to throw a label at you and hope it sticks.
And isn't this just what happens when people get into power? And when I say into power, I'm not just talking about government. I'm also talking about people that have accepted a certain narrative and find that there's a lot of other people that are along with them in the same narrative. And they have these media pylons, like social media pylons, where they'll attack people. And like you, call you an anti-vaxxer even though you've been vaccinated. The same thing with Eric Clapton. They were angry at Eric Clapton because he spoke openly about his very extreme vaccine side effects. Just speaking openly as a person who was vaccinated. And they called him a vile anti-vaxxer.
Well, the question is why, right? And it's to shut debate down.
Yes.
Now, why would you want to shut debate down? I think there's a deeper point here. And that is that we've just come out of a time where, for a long time, moral and, let's just say, relativism, whether it's moral or otherwise, relativism, this idea that truth is relative, this idea that that it's all subjective, that everything is personal experience, that's being promoted. Yeah, there's no such thing as reality, whether it comes down to defining a man or woman. We spoke about this last time I was here with Sam as well. We spoke about the trans debate and man and woman. Whether it's defining a man and a woman, whether it's anything else, this idea that actually truth is all personally subjective.
Right.
When you promote the idea that there's no such thing as truth, and when you shut down debate that is seeking truth, not that it claims truth, but is seeking it, when you shut that debate down in aid of this idea that truth is relative, like those, for example, who now know the science that the COVID vaccination doesn't stop or doesn't stop infection or transmission and doesn't reduce it beyond 12 weeks. The booster shot, by the way, is 8 weeks. But having known that, and they still insist on vaccine passports, it's no longer about seeking the truth for them. The truth is relative and it serves a purpose. What happens when you do that? When there's no such thing as truth, you can't define reality. And when you can't define reality, the only thing that matters is power. You're a father. Now, we are children who can't reason. Like my kid's five. I mean, his reasoning abilities are great, but he's five, right? It's why you say to the child, because I said so, do it. It's good for you. Because they don't know how to reason yet, yeah? And you try, and if something's too complex, you say, I'll explain another time, but right now you have to listen to your father, don't do this. When there's no such thing as truth, because everything's relative, the only thing that matters is power, because power gets to define reality. And this brings us to the hybrid war we're in right now. And that's why people that are in power, who are seeking a specific outcome from the world that we're in, want to shut debate down. What they're not interested in is seeking truth. What they're interested in is shutting that debate down, because power steps into that void when reason no longer exists and gets to define reality for you from up above. And it's why it's so important in a dictatorship that the only thing you have left when all your power is taken from you is the truth. And if you read Orwell, if you look at 1984, it's why he spends so much time talking about how the power he was writing about in that fictional account is attempting to redefine reality, redefine the past, redefine the future. Because if you can't hold on to reality, you have no premise to scrutinize the government for whether they're telling you the truth or not. And it is a war in that sense, hybrid war. So information in that war becomes your most powerful weapon. Now, most people don't have the privilege of researching these debates, foreign policy, war on terror, COVID, whatever it is. People don't have the privilege because they're working 9 to 5, a minimum wage, and they're hungry and they're just busy trying to live and survive. What they normally do is they outsource their thinking on where the truth lies to trusted voices in the media. So it's why it becomes so important to manipulate the media, so that those trusted voices that people are looking to are no longer giving them at least the best understanding of the truth they have, but are also peddling the agenda of power. When you're in a situation like that, it becomes difficult to define reality and therefore difficult to challenge government on whether or not they are sticking to their promises, because everything gets shifted. Everything's relative. The Overton window keeps moving. The goalposts keep shifting. If you remember back at the beginning of this, we were told 2 weeks, whatever it was.
Flatten the curve.
Flatten the curve, yeah. Now look at us 2 years later, and right, we're here still.
Well, look at Montreal. They're still locked down right now. They can't go out at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. The goalposts keep shifting, and you're expected to forget what you were told last time.
Right.
In the UK, we were told specifically 2 weeks, and then it went from 2 weeks to flatten the curve to we're only going to just wait in lockdown. And by the way, we had a national lockdown, a very long one, yeah, we're all confined to our homes. And they said, just wait. We're going to inoculate the most vulnerable. Just think of granny. Don't kill granny, yeah? So, by the way, my grandmother died in all of this. So, again, I'm not anti-grandmother, yeah? I wasn't allowed to attend her on her deathbed while the Prime Minister and all of his special advisors and all of the cabinet were drinking with cheese and wine parties in Downing Street, breaking all the rules, which has all come out now in the press. And it's not just me. Many people in the UK went through that horrific experience. We couldn't even visit our dying relatives, and they were partying meanwhile. The health secretary caught on video camera having an affair in his office, in government offices.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show is here alternating Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. You're listening to a special hour excerpt of Majid Nawaz talking to Joe Rogan, recorded on February 17th. Now back to the show.
We went through that whole lockdown. It went from 2 weeks to flatten the curve to, okay, just wait until we just vaccinate the vulnerable. Then it was, we're just wait, we're going to vaccinate everyone over 40, which is when I originally got it, right? Now I'm 44. Then it was, just wait until we vaccinate all the adults and get herd immunity. Then they shifted the goalposts again. Just wait until we vaccinate the kids. Now, the JCVI in the UK, the Joint Committee for Vaccination and Immunisation, failed, did not recommend to the government, they failed to recommend vaccinating children. Government went ahead anyway, said, no, we have to vaccinate the kids. You keep shifting the goalposts, like 1984, George Orwell, and you keep telling people, gaslighting the people, that's not what we said. No, that's not what, we didn't just say, wait until we did, you know, vaccinate. No, you're getting it wrong. Kept gaslighting the people, shifting the definition of reality, playing with people's memories. Now, that serves a purpose in this hybrid war, in which information is the weapon. It serves a purpose because you've got to disorient, confuse, and create self-doubt in the citizens so they no longer have the strength to question government for what they said and what they didn't deliver, or what they did deliver when they weren't meant to. And that's how you stymie or handicap any opposition. And in the UK, again, because there was a bipartisan consensus, even the opposition party, like with Iraq, they kept saying to every crisis, the solution was harsher restrictions. In the end, people, the only way, when you're in that situation where you've been locked in your homes, where the state's telling you you have to get injected or you lose your job, right? When you've lost all your rights, even by law, because the Emergency Act came in and we weren't even legally allowed to oppose any of this. In the end, you're in a situation, the only way people get their rights back from tyranny is by taking them through activism. You never, in that situation, the state never just gives your rights back. Now, when I say taking them, I mean civil action. I mean protests. I mean activism. I don't mean violence. But that's why if you look to the example of England, unlike Wales and Scotland, there were huge protests and a lot of voices, not just mine, were fierce on this to a point where England had to, you know, they couldn't, they just retreated on all of this now. And all of the, everything I've been saying, you take up masks, you take lockdowns, you take mandatory vaccines. And I've only ever been opposed to mandates, by the way, right? It's only about mandates for me, whether you define mandates as lockdowns or mask mandates or vaccine mandates. For me, it's the force bit that I don't like. I'm double jabbed, again, to remind everyone. But everything we were saying, that mask mandates are useless, that the virus particles are millions of times smaller than the cloth mask they were telling everybody to use, that testing continuously was actually making the problem worse, that PCR tests were unreliable. They ditched the PCR tests. That lockdowns, did anyone ever think of what we call an impact assessment? They're going to lock you in your homes to save X number of lives. Does that kill Y number of people more? In other words, does it kill more people than we're saving? Because if you were opposed to the lockdowns in those days, oh, you want to kill granny. And my question was, if I save one granny, am I killing 10?
Isn't the way to find that out to look at overall death?
Yeah.
And whether or not it changes year after year after year?
Yeah. We have so this is the interesting point. So since being, we'll get to what I'm doing next in terms of my media work, but very quickly, I started as a Substack after my services were no longer required. Mm. And one of the things I put up in there, the last one I wrote, is this idea that this ONS statistic, the Office for National Statistics, that came out with the Freedom of Information request, and they said, yeah, 17,000, whatever it was, 730, whatever, people died from COVID since the beginning of this pandemic, right? And we were told it's hundreds of thousands. But there is a spike in all-cause mortality. Now, if it's not from COVID, what's causing it? That's a question that remains open. The Times of London reported that there's been a 25% spike in heart attacks in Scotland. Professor Norman Fenton and Professor Neil from Queen Mary Westfield University in London, part of the University of London, have looked at this and said there's a five-year high in all-cause mortality. Now, if there's a 25% spike in heart attacks in Scotland that are as of yet unexplained, there's a five-year spike in all-cause mortality, but COVID deaths are similar to flu deaths, then what's causing all these excess deaths?
Well, how many of those people survived COVID and then had heart attacks later? Because that is one of the side effects of COVID, is blood clots, heart issues.
So Professor Fenton, and I say he's done the research, not me. All I'm saying is floating the question, saying these need answers. He said that these specific spikes in deaths were specifically after vaccination.
And were those people also infected with COVID?
I don't think so from memory, but I'd have to look at that.
The big distinction when it comes to myocarditis and all these different things. Like, what if you have both?
Yeah.
You know, like, what if it's an issue that where they got a bad case of COVID even though they were vaccinated?
Yeah.
What do you blame it on then?
So to break that question down, we have to look at with COVID and off COVID deaths as well, right?
Right.
So the health secretary, by the way, these talking points that you've obviously heard over the last 2 years, every single one of them in the UK has now been conceded to. This whole distinction, death of COVID with COVID.
They're doing that now. It's fascinating to watch. Even the CDC. Yeah.
Every single one.
Including the debate about natural immunity. Yeah. It's almost like they've gotten to the point where to maintain future credibility, they have to admit these absolute truths that everyone else already knows.
Yeah. So the health secretary in the UK came out and admitted that the COVID deaths have been overestimated because there's been a mix between with COVID and of COVID, right? We also know that, again, memory, so forgive me if this is off, but from memory, 2/3 of COVID cases were caught after hospital admission rather than because of COVID.
Right, they're hospitalized for something else.
They get COVID in hospital.
That's a big thing with young people.
Now, if you put all of that together and you recognize that there's 17,000 roughly deaths only of COVID and there's this spike, 5-year spike in all-cause mortality, it wouldn't make sense to say, did they have COVID as well, when we know that only 17,000 only, one death is too many, but 17,000 died only of COVID, and that a lot of these people were getting COVID in hospital, right? And it's a similar thing. Like, I'm going to show you this. Can we do something?
Yeah.
The Independent newspaper, there's this gold medalist Olympian weightlifter from Hungary. His name was Sylvester something, but if you look up The Independent anti-vax gold medalist dead, this is today's news, right? I've got it here as well because I put it out earlier.
You could airdrop that to Jamie if you'd like. Oh, here you go.
There it is. Right, look at that headline. See that headline,
Anti-vax Olympic gold medalist Sylvester Solony. Can you know how to say his name?
I think Sylvester Solony.
It's spelled with a lot of different words. S-Z-I-L-V-E-S-Z-T-E-R. C-S-O-L-L-A-N-Y. So he died of COVID, age 51, and they're calling him an anti-vax.
Yep. Now, if you scroll down, please, sir, Jamie. Scroll down to that. Go hit. You have to.
Oh, you have to register.
Oh, okay. So I've got it on my phone. Can I send it to you?
Yeah.
How do I do that?
Actually, you might not be able to because it's. Is this on a? Can he?
I'll try later. Hit that. I'll try later. Hit the I'll try later, and you'll get to the article. Yeah, there we are. Right.
Okay.
Now, if you go down to. Yeah, there we are. That paragraph, while Kaslonly had, according to the publication, paragraph above it,
he contacted the virus soon after receiving his jab.
Do you see that?
So they called him an anti-vaxxer.
Six-time world championship medalist had been vaccinated to allow him to continue work as a gymnastics coach. However, he contracted the virus soon after receiving his jab. And the headline calls him an anti-vaxxer and says he dies. Now, this is the manipulation that's been going on. This is from today's press. It's still going on.
He had not built sufficient levels of antibodies.
So he was jabbed. So back to your question, what's causing this spike? 5-year spike in all-cause mortality.
But how crazy is it that that's how they decide to portray him? They
go back to the headline.
I mean, that's folly, right? They make him look like a fool.
It's deceit.
Yeah. Well, it's this narrative that they want to push, where whenever someone questions whether it's Eric Clapton or yourself or anyone, they'll call you an anti-vaxxer.
This man was
such a pedor. Yeah.
Now, so why I showed you that is back to that question. If they die after the vaccination, one of the things Norman Fenton, professor from Queen Mary Westfield, in response to your question that did they have COVID too, right, is first of all, we know the COVID deaths are 17,000. So, and we know the majority of hospitalized cases of COVID were caught after hospitalization. We also know, in his study, he says they died soon after the vaccination, right? Now, you want to look at this. And now, I'm not giving you a reason for why there's an all 5-year spike. I'm saying these questions, as somebody that works in media, these questions demand answers. And he's looked at this and he said, Professor Fenton and Neil from Queen Mary's, and they've said, these deaths were soon after vaccination, this spike, right? And they're saying their view is they have to interrogate whether the vaccination itself, whether it caused myocarditis or any other negative reaction that's caused this spike in deaths. And that, by the way, that spike, it could then be you go to hospital and you catch COVID in hospital. But that's not the reason you're in hospital. We already know that.
Right.
So these are, in ordinary times, whether it's with a thalidomide scandal that historically led to babies being born, without their limbs intact, whether it's, the CIA example I gave you with the hepatitis B fake vaccination program in Pakistan, whether it's the Tuskegee experimentation on African-Americans here, we know this malpractice occurs, right? We know that abuse has happened historically. Now, here you've got a vaccine that has just been rolled out, hasn't been tested in the long term, and we've got some alarming figures of all-cause spike in mortality, and we know in instances that there is a side effect of death, as in the case of BBC journalist Lisa Shaw, who the coroner ruled specifically died because of AstraZeneca, the vaccine. So there are multiple questions here that demand answers, but asking those questions without drawing conclusions, by the way, I have never on air discouraged anybody to get the vaccine. People used to call it as a call-in show. Members of the public would call in. Imagine sitting there for 3 hours, I give a monologue for 20 minutes and then I'm open season. Anyone can call and interrogate me. It's good for practice in debates, but point is, people would call up and say, should I get the jab, Majid? I'd say, I'm not a doctor, I can't advise you. I'm talking about mandates because I tell you one thing I am, as a postgraduate of political theory, I understand how political systems work. And my concern is more on a macro level. these questions about deaths, what I'm concerned about is that the people who ask these questions, suddenly you find they lose their jobs, they become stigmatized, and that kind of behavior I've seen happen before, because that's what happens in tyranny when you question authority. It's what happened to us, and it's what these great historical literary figures have always advised us to question, whether it's Orwell, whether it's the Gulag Archipelago, whether it's Solzhenitsyn, whether it's, and we have that experience because of the Soviet Union, right? We understand Darkness at Noon, right? These books, Catch-22, Joseph Heller, about the absurdity of rules and bureaucracy that don't make sense. The entire point of these books is to teach us, do not just succumb to whatever the bureaucracy is telling you, but ask questions where things don't make sense. And when people are trying to shut those debates down, that says more to me about what's going on than anything else.
Isn't it universal, though, in terms of like world government? There's not world government that I'm aware of that's very open about what's going on, about failures and mistakes and not understanding the information correctly because they were under an assumption that proved to be incorrect. It's essentially across the board. And isn't part of that just managing some sort of large-scale pandemic with a large population of people and trying to make sense of it all?
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how do you manage that? And you have to have two different things going on. You have to have actual solutions like medication, and you also have to have optics. You have to give the people the impression that you're managing this and you're working very hard to figure this out, and you've come to some uncomfortable conclusions and you made some decisions that maybe are going to upset people, but they're going to help everyone overall.
So we need to go to the origins of COVID to see, again, on a global level then, were they acting in good faith? Right? Now, all the evidence currently indicates no.
And when you say they, who do you mean by they?
People in power.
All the people in power are acting in bad faith?
The people in power that are interacting in our reality. Yeah?
I mean, when we're talking about like leaks and emails that have been exposed, mm-hmm. when you talk about conversations between people that worked in the Wuhan lab, and those are being exposed to us very recently.
Yeah.
I'm under no impression that politicians were aware of these emails before us.
So the lab leak, let's talk through that example, yeah? So one thing we can say, I think quite fairly, is I doubt Fauci's acting in the best possible way he should be acting, right? So he knew about this lab leak thing from the very beginning, and the leaks that have now come out, even the DARPA leaks themselves, indicate that they attempted to suffocate this story. In the UK, we have a similar example, Lancet, which is a very well-respected medical journal. One of the guys that, well, actually the guy that Fauci's federal funding supported, his name is Peter Daszak, EcoHealth Alliance. Yeah. He's a Brit.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones engaged in gain-of-function research in Wuhan in that lab. Now, there was a letter very early on, and I was, from the beginning, I was questioning the lab leak thing, and again, getting into trouble for doing so. But this is before any of the leaks. But there was still evidence to indicate something wasn't right here.
Brett Weinstein talked about
That's
it
right.
on
I
my
had
podcast
on my show. Yeah.
Very early
yeah,
on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he's an evolutionary biologist. He understood
exactly.
the actual
And that's why I got him on
itself.
My show as well. There's a video of him on my show talking about this, right? Now, what happened is that this guy that Fauci was funding, Peter Daszak and the EcoHealth Alliance, that's not in dispute that they received federal funding. Fauci in Congress testified and said it wasn't gain of function to Senator Rumpel's sort of hearings. And the leaks have subsequently indicated that they did know that this funding was being used in the lab in Wuhan to make this virus sticky, to make it stronger, and to make it work for humans, to actually infect humans. Now, Peter Daszak, again, very early on, co-authored a letter in The Lancet, which is a very respected medical journal in the UK, in which, before these leaks came out, they declared that anybody who questions whether this was leaked from a lab is a conspiracy theorist. And it was signed by a number of doctors, and it was among them Peter Daszak. Peter Daszak's the guy that got the funding to do this work. At the bottom of all medical journal articles, you have to declare an interest. Are there any conflicts? And they said, we have no conflicts of interest. So here you've got that these guys wrote a hit piece calling anybody like Brett who questions whether it's a lab leak a conspiracy theorist, while obviously it's him, Peter Daszak, receiving funding to do that very work, writing a piece in a medical journal, smearing those who are attempting to uncover whether he'd received funding to do that very work. I think I'm qualified enough in the human, in human nature, at least, to be able to say he wasn't acting in our best interest.
That's a conflict.
That's a conflict. And that, you see, from the very beginning of this thing, it happened with everything we were saying. Lab leak, masks, lockdowns, mandates. Eventually, the truth came out, but it had to be fought for. So that tells me that the people that were attempting to suffocate this truth, at least, not everybody, but the people that were involved in suffocating the truth and smearing dissidents while knowing, because the leaks indicate that they knew, right? They weren't acting in our best interests. And I think that's a fair conclusion to reach. What were they doing? They were attempting to use this emergency to usher in a new way of doing things. Vaccine passports, even though in the UK and England, at least now, we've dropped them, and Ireland followed suit, the Czech Republic has followed suit. But it wasn't ever about you not being able to come into, say, into this studio and infect me, because even after they learned that you could still infect me, the vaccine passports were still in place. But they've told us, they meaning people in power, have told us what they want to do next. So the UK is currently the head of the G7 group. That's the world's most economically advanced countries. And the UK currently chairs the G7 group. Our chancellor, who does our economy, called Chancellor of the Exchequer, his name's Rishi Sunak. He's put out this video. This is all on my feeds, by the way, my social feeds. He put out this video saying that what they want to do is bring in this thing called the central banking digital currency. They want to replace fiat paper money with digital money as a competitor to Bitcoin and crypto money, right? But instead of being a decentralized currency, it will be controlled by a government. It's digital currency, but controlled centrally through the banks, Bank of England. So instead of having a bank account with whatever, HSBC or Bank of America, you'll have a bank account directly with, in the American context, with the Fed. In the UK, directly with the Bank of England. You have a personal bank account, and you're given digital money in that bank account. These are called central banking digital currencies. The Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK has already announced their intention to do this as the G7 group. And these are, if you look up...
this sounds terrifying.
If you look up the Telegraph newspaper...
I've already Googled it, and there's a lot of headlines about it.
Yep, there's a specific article in the Telegraph, programmable digital currency, yeah? If you can't find it, I'll pull it out from my Twitter feed, and we can talk through it on my feed, but... while he's looking for that, I'll talk you through it. So one of these...
central bank digital currency, is that the one down below?
Digital currency should be programmable. See that one there? Yeah? He's looking at it even on the search. It says the word programmable. The top search result. Yep, so, third line down.
Yeah, I see in that.
Yep, should be programmable.
Yep.
Mm. Programming, yeah? Now, see, again, there's a paywall, but maybe...
Start your free trial.
Yeah, but you can see the word there, right? Programming in the headline. Now, what they're doing is they're saying... that this digital currency, once you're, because, you know, everyone knows that with inflation at over 5%, it's now 5.4%, right? Our fiat money, the paper money, is increasingly becoming worthless, and we're headed towards a big disaster. The Fed wants to raise interest rates. But we're in so much debt that if you raise interest rates, people are going to suffer, because everyone, we're living on debt as Western economies. So they realize that this kind of, the lifespan of paper money is fast coming to an end because of the 2008 economic crash in particular. So they're bringing in these central banking digital currencies. Why is that word programmable in there? So what they said in that article, and the Chancellor put a video out saying this as well, they said, right, think back to what vaccine passports were, yeah? If you don't have your jab, you can't even eat in this restaurant. What they've said, and why the word programmable was in that headline was, they've said that this money that you will earn from work, instead of having paper money, you have this digital money. It's programmable so that you can't buy certain foods, or if you do something that your employer doesn't like, it's all in that article. You won't be able to spend your money. In other words, it's not money. They're vouchers. They're like food vouchers. And they can be programmed so that, like the Chinese social credit system, that if you try and use them on a certain thing, it won't work. You say you want to buy a burger and they want you to buy bugs, which is one of the examples used. If you start to try and buy unhealthy meat, just won't work. You tap your card, you can't buy the thing because you've met your quota that month of burgers. You have to buy something like a vegan meal.
So yeah? It won't just be money in the sense of the way we have dollars or pounds today.
Yeah.
It'll be something that's controlled in terms of your ability to distribute it.
Which is why I'm calling it a voucher. It's a coupon.
But even a coupon, if you have a coupon to buy bread, you can still buy the bread. Yeah. Like, there's
but you can't buy, see that coupon to buy bread, what you can't do is buy a burger with that coupon. It's for bread.
Right,
yeah?
Right.
So you will have the central banking digital currency. And then what they're talking about in that article that we just pulled up is they'll say, right, and it explicitly uses the words, won't be used on something that the employer deems inappropriate or the state deems inappropriate.
Oh, we got to see this. Yeah? See if we can find that. Or
I'm just digging also, through a different article about it too. It's talking about there's pilot programs going to be used in the Olympics coming up in China.
Yep.
They've already started it. And
right now,
do you feel like you're sounding the alarm
yes.
for people that don't understand what is going on?
So here, I'll put it up for you here. Yeah. So there's the video.
Yeah.
I don't know if your camera can see that, but there's the video. There's him speaking about it.
G7 is launching a set of public policy principles for retail central bank digital currencies,
yep.
CBDCs. Central bank digital currencies could be a digital version of money, a bit like a digital banknote that could be used alongside...
Right, so that's the guy who runs our economy in the UK. His name's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And here is the article. Bank of England tells ministers to intervene on digital currency programming. Yeah, and here's a quote from the article. This is in the Telegraph, the one he pulled up, but it was behind a paywall, so I'll just read the quote. Digital cash could be programmed to ensure it is only spent on essentials or goods which an employer or government deems to be sensible.
Oh,
I'm going to take it one step further for you, Joe, right? So the vaccine passport infrastructure is in place. But now we know that the vaccine doesn't stop infection or transmission, but the checkpoint Charlie exists everywhere. They bring in digital banking, central banking digital currencies. You've got a scenario now that you're checking in and out everywhere you go using vouchers that are programmed and you can only spend where you're told you can spend them. There's another word for that, man. That's called the Chinese social credit system. That's what it's called. And anyone who watches Black Mirror will know what I'm talking about. That's that TV show, right?
Yeah.
So what they are telling us, and when I say they, who's they? People in power. That's the head of our economy, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, second most powerful person other than the Prime Minister and maybe the Foreign Secretary in the UK, right? He's telling us, I just played it there for you. He's telling us that's what he, as the UK, the head of the G7, want to bring in for the G7. So a scenario where, like in New York at the moment, because the passport infrastructure is in place, you bring in that digital currency and you've got this total control. And if I'm speaking to you the way I'm speaking now, and my employer or government, you heard that in the quote directly, yeah, deems me as saying or doing something inappropriate, suddenly I can't actually pay to come here and speak to you anymore. My digital currency won't even pay for the ticket because it will be known that I'm coming to speak to you. Sorry, your vouchers don't allow you to purchase that ticket to go and speak to Joe.
And this is where we get into the kind of censorship that we see in social media that is not, it's not, you can't have that kind of censorship with the First Amendment in normal discourse. Mm. But you can have that kind of censorship if you've developed a digital platform that distributes information, but it's a private company.
Yeah.
So think about what money is, where you can spend it on whatever you want, versus this digital currency, which is essentially controlled. In a sense,
yeah.
Like you have free speech on Twitter, but you really don't.
Because
if you go too far or you talk about something that they don't find appropriate, they'll just ban your account. That could be what we're looking at in terms of what we think of as free speech being social media platforms, could be what we think of as your free range ability to buy whatever you want with whatever money that you've earned.
So what's going on here, right? We're in a moment in history, and this is why I said to you what I can speak to you about with a bit more authority than even the science debate. And I've done my homework on the science debate. I had to because I had a live show, and I was interrogated by the public for 3 hours on a call-in show. I had to have done my homework. And the way you've seen me be able to pull out my receipts, yeah?
Yes.
That's what I had to do on the show. But put the science aside. Where I will speak with a level of authority is political theory, right? I'm a postgraduate in that, and I spent my entire life involved in political structures and political activism and thinking about social contracts. Now, what's going on here is, with this central banking digital currency, if you get to that situation where you end up with the Chinese social credit system in the West, why? Why would anyone want to do that, right? I believe we're in a moment of the Gutenberg press. Go back to when the printing press was invented. Technology disrupts power structures. It always has. Printing and its invention was a new technology. What happened when they invented the printing press? The power structures, who up until that point were reading the Bible for you and were telling you that you were to pay this priest X amount of favors and he'll forgive you your sins. And that became a bribery system, right? Which is what Martin Luther was so upset about when he pinned his thesis to the wall. The printing press disrupted that power dynamic because people could read the Bible for themselves. And they began realizing that the power structures were manipulating what was written to control people. Now, nobody in hindsight is going to argue that printing and its invention is a bad thing for humanity. But at the time, it led to war. It led to the 30 Years' War in Europe because it disrupted power so much that people began rising up, and it led to this 30-year period of war, which eventually led to the Reformation, and the rest is history, right? What's today's Gutenberg press? The internet. The decentralization of information, and then because of that, the internet, the decentralization of currency in the form of crypto is disrupting power. Because the way that after the revolution of the Reformation, the printing press, control was still possible, though obviously not to that level, which is why we no longer have those absolute monarchies. But control in a nation state context was still possible to an extent because the money supply was controlled. Now what's happening is that the invention of the internet with the decentralization of information, and in particular here, the decentralization of currency in the form of cryptocurrencies, is disrupting those power hierarchies, and it's leading to this conflict now. And we're in a moment. When the printing press was invented, the powers that be needed to try and hold on to that power as the 30 Years' War kicked off. They eventually lost it. But to hold on to it, they became very brutal because they were losing their grip on power. Today, this is what I believe we're witnessing. It's not about vaccine passports. This was a red herring. To have the infrastructure in place that you can have a Checkpoint Charlie society, so that when the central banking digital currencies are in place, that infrastructure is already there because people were so scared they voluntarily allowed you to put that in place, so that you can maintain your grip on power, because what's coming around the corner is the decentralization of everything, of media, therefore of narrative. And of course, remember, whoever defines the truth gets to define reality. Decentralization of narratives, decentralization of the economy through crypto. You no longer have the power to define the story and control the money supply. So the powers that be, who are losing that power, need to clamp down. They're clamping down on their own children, because we are people who are born of the West. So it's an internal civil war in a hybrid war context over truth and over information. Centralization versus decentralization, basically. It's no longer about left or right. It's about up versus down. It's about power versus those who don't have power.
Do you think if there was no cryptocurrency, if there was no Bitcoin or any of the other crypto coins, that they would attempt to do some sort of digital currency? Do you think that this is a response to the understanding that that decentralized digital currency is eventually going to take over or has gained far more momentum than they ever anticipated?
I think so. And also decentralized media, because you can't control the narrative.
Right.
See how easy it was to convince everybody initially that the Iraq war was needed, right? Now, you've got a point today where they haven't been able to convince people of their measures that they wanted to bring in when COVID struck, because it was quicker to be able to unpick that narrative due to decentralization. Shows like this that weren't under the traditional yoke of traditional media were able to have certain conversations. Now, that means that it's harder to control the narrative. And so in a situation like that, when you're losing your grip and power, the only option you have left is to clamp down. And I'm so sorry to say, but that means, like the 30 years war in Europe after the printing press was invented, we may be in for a bit of a rough ride ahead. But we are literally facing a crossroads. Do we go down the direction of centralization or decentralization? It's obvious where I stand. I think ultimately, like happened eventually after the wars of 30 years war, and eventually people need to be respected and they will win. They will win this and we'll end up with a better future. But there's going to be some short-term pain.
And what do you mean by that?
There'll be another emergency, whether it's war with Russia, which is already being played up, whatever it is, whether it's the crash of the economy because of the fiat and the inflation at 5.4%, at least in the UK, it's 5.4% here. I know it's out of control here as well. If the currency collapses because we're living on printed money at the moment, it's called quantitative easing. We are literally printing ourselves money to try and pay for our debt. We're just printing more money. That's unsustainable. So we're in this situation where any other crisis could occur. If the gas, Putin controls Europe's gas supply. If there's a war with Ukraine, he cuts off the gas supply. There's a Nord Stream 2 pipeline that services Germany, but also other European countries are dependent on Russian gas. So if he shuts off the gas supply, you end up with food shortages. Now, you can go one of two ways. If there's riots because people are hungry, that's a perfect pretext to bring in more draconian power to control society. And people will want it because nobody wants to live in, like, with riots. I mean, people moving away from the West Coast and San Francisco in particular because of some of the crime problems there, right? So people move away from that. But if you've got food shortages everywhere and people end up rioting, it's a good reason to say, right, we need more power to control this. We need more emergency powers. We need stronger laws. And so you end up in a situation where crises can be manipulated to bring in stronger and stronger authority, when really what's going on is we're in this crossroads in history. Now, we will get out of this because ultimately it's a numbers game. And ultimately, in times like this, you end up fighting against your own sons, right? It's those in power fighting their own people. And eventually the people are, by sheer numbers, you know, end up becoming the people in power, right? So in the long run, we may well end up in a decentralized world, which will be much better. But as I say, that to get there, we have to get through this period of those in power attempting to hold on to that power.
Do you think it's possible that we won't get there and then we'll wind up in a more draconian centralized world?
Everything's possible. Professor John Gray at the LSE questions the idea that history moves in a positive trajectory. He questions the idea that we're only ever going to get better. His theory is in the context of liberalism. We must never take anything for granted, but it's why I've been so vocal. Because everything we've just spoken about, I've looked at this, I've had to reason myself out of totalitarian systems. And so when I see that what I joined, kind of our values that we believe and hold dear to, our civil liberties, what I sacrifice things to defend, if the thing I'm defending is moving in that direction as well, I can see that pattern. I can see the early warning signs. Hannah Arendt is a German Jewish philosopher, was. She wrote about the rise of totalitarianism in Germany to try and understand it. In fact, was one of the leading and first philosophers to try and dissect totalitarianism and how it emerged. And she coined this theory, which is, everybody can look it up. It's called the banality of evil. And her basic point was, she ended up living her final years in Israel, and she was really interested in understanding how ordinary, everyday, nice people became Nazis. Yeah? And the banality of evil is her theory that explains it. And the point was that actually good people can do evil things, and they don't even realize they're doing them. And it's incremental. It's step by step. And each incremental step is justified for the common good. Until the like a proverbial frog being boiled alive in water, and because it's a frog and its skin temperature changes with the water, it doesn't realize it's being boiled alive until it's too late and it dies with the boiling water. It doesn't jump out.
Mm.
So that take that proverb, that story, and apply it to Hannah Arendt's theory of the banality of evil. That if you incrementally change, step by step, you change society, before you even realize it, you've got to a point that it's past the point of no return. If that happens, it's very difficult to get out of that without external intervention.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You've been listening to a very special two-hour presentation of Majid Nawaz talking to Joe Rogan, recorded on February 17th. My show runs every other Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. I'll see you again in 2 weeks with more information.
Like nobody's business. Mama's nursing help running the healthy family. There's nothing she won't do. Around. She helped us kids get through with less risk for ear infections. And